As you're taking your seats, go ahead and grab your Bible. Go back to the Old Testament. We're back in the book of Esther. We will be there unpacking Esther's story over these next few weeks in our series called Back Against the Wall. The series is built upon the idea that there are just some moments in our life that we get pushed and shoved against the wall. We feel like we run into a wall, if you will. Now, when you get to that wall, you can do a couple things. You can stand and you can face that wall, and you can put your nose on that wall, and you can stay there. You can let that wall hit you so hard, or you hit the wall so hard, you just crumple like a little piece of dust at the bottom of it and lay there. Or you have the choice of turning around, placing your back firmly against it, and pushing off of that wall into the world so that you can face whatever it is that has backed you into that corner. The book of Esther is a book that is a fascinating book, but it's a book where they have their backs against the wall. And a lot of things that happen in the book of Esther impact our lives and have a lot to do with the world that we live in, maybe in ways that we've never thought before. I told you when we started this series last week that we would hopefully take a look at a story that might be familiar to some of you, but also look at it in a way that's brand new, look at it with a new set of fresh eyes and see some things that maybe you haven't seen before. And so we've done that. Today we continue that by talking about faith in a faith-filled, faithless world. Now say that three times fast. Faith in a faith-filled, faithless world. That's the title. I'm going to explain the title in just a few minutes, but that's what we're going to talk about this morning. But also, if you notice that there are some folks that are wandering around today look a little bit like zombies, that's because we are in the midst of an event called Face the Fear. It opened this weekend. Friday night was a pretty slow night with crowds. We weren't real thrilled about that, but it was one of those nights where the weirdest things happened, because normally, historically, for Face the Fear, we will open the door, and inevitably for the first hour, it is the roughest ride and the most terrifying thing that you've ever been a part of, because everything seems to break. It goes wrong. We have to fix it on the fly, and then you've got someone that's waiting to come through. Inevitably, something we're trying to fix something and hide in the dark while someone else comes walking by, and it's a nightmare. Friday night opened, and everything worked perfectly. I mean, it's the first time in 20-some-odd years I think everything worked perfectly. Everything fired, nothing misfired, you know, everything was working, and there were no people here to go through it. I mean, the crowds just kind of trickled in, you know, it was slow. We were doing everything we could to keep entertaining them, you know, give them another loop in the back 40, you know, whatever we could do to keep people here. He was busy. So it was a very, very slow night, and thinking, man, what is going on? Discouraging as that was, last night was not that night. Last night we ran from early on until the very last minute. We filled every slot that we had, and it worked well again. And so kudos to the folks that are working out there. If you haven't looked out there, you can give them a hand. They did a great job. We've constructed things that we've never tried to build before. There's some things out there that we've never put into the mix before. We've expanded and blown out things that we've never done before. And it is a real experience through an old cursed mind, if you will. And it's been fun. If you are into such things, and not that you should be, but we're doing it. This morning on FloridaHauntedHouses.com, or actually last night, we get reviews. You get reviews. That kind of makes or breaks, you know, what you do year after year. And so we get reviews. We have been given the first two reviews that popped up gave us 5 out of 5 possible pumpkins, so that's good. One of the headlines says, "So much fun and so very scary." The other one said, "Scary to the max." And I told Max Simmons last night, I said, "They're talking about you, man. This is all about you." For whatever reason, you made such an impact. They did it to you. But those reviews are out there if you want to. But I also shared at 9 o'clock, I'll share with you, what set us apart, what really kind of put us on the radar of being a group of people that were able to scare people and do it differently, was a group called Horror Find. They're an organization that ranks nationally what they call the haunted houses, the best scare experiences out there. And a few years ago, for whatever reason, we were in their radar. And what they do is they send people in, and you don't know who they are, and it's kind of like a mystery diner thing. And they just do the whole experience. They never let on who they are. And then what they do is they post reviews for you, and they also contact you and tell you a variety of things. And one year they came out and went through it, and we hit. They loved it. Their headline was Better Than Halloween Horror Nights. And from then on, we were off and running. At that point, we were off and running, and there was never any turning back. And then, of course, that created other people looking at us. And then before, AOL had named us one year one of the top 10 places in the country to come. I mean, it was just crazy stuff that started to happen, and God began really blessing what we were doing, as weird as that sounds. Last night, this came in. I saw it this morning. It said, this was from Horrifying. It says, Horrifying has had the pleasure of ranking fright attractions throughout the country for a number of years. Recently, our founder has passed away. So we're finishing up this Halloween season by doing some of the things that we have done in the past, but this will be the last time. Last night, October 23rd, we visited and experienced Silence, as presented by Face to Fear. The guest interaction prior to the event was outstanding. Your team, working, and the guest relations could not have been better. We had all the information we needed, had fun, and had a snack. The event itself was also amazing. We loved the story and thought it was interesting that you were trying to get us to scream after you had insisted that we stay silent. I'm sure that is causing some uncomfortable moments for your guests, but making people uncomfortable and frightened is what you do, and you have done so well. Great cast, fantastic monsters in the woods, loved the rustic buildings and the sets that captured an old mining town. The working sluice was a great touch, and nicely constructed water effect for your bridge. Getting a chance to experience the maze was a blast, and then thinking we were done only to have to figure out that the code that Bob supposedly gave us didn't work. But it was a nice finish. Loved the horror films you created as bonus features. Got a chance to watch the first couple of the Fear Virus episodes. And then they added this phrase. This is perhaps the most pleasing thing about your haunted attraction. It has a purpose. We are thrilled to award you a 10 out of a possible 10. Well done, Face to Fear. And I mean, the folks that have worked on it, the cast last night, it was our largest cast ever this weekend. I mean, they have just done an amazing job. But it dawned on me that phrase, the most pleasing thing about your attraction is it has a purpose. You know, there are a lot of places you can go, and there's a lot of things you can pay for to be entertained, but then you have to ask yourself from time to time, is there a purpose behind it? Now, the purpose could be entertainment. Nothing wrong with that. Don't misread that. But as a follower of Christ, one of the things that you've got to come to grips with is that if you get this day as a gift from God, there's a purpose to it. God just wasn't willy-nilly sitting up there going, hey, you know what, I'm just going to give you another day. Have at it. You know, if he gave you today, and you're here, and you ain't dead yet, you got something that you're supposed to be doing, something that's supposed to be happening in your world, and something that's supposed to be happening in your life. And as a result of that, we find ourselves in now trying to flesh out our faith in a world that sometimes doesn't make it feel very easy. Sometimes it gets a little complicated. Sometimes, to be honest with you, it's a little difficult. And we want to get it right, and we want to do it well. You wouldn't be here if you didn't want to do that. And so the question is, how do we do that? And that's what this series is about. How do we navigate that? Last week, we took our dive into the book of Esther for the first time, and we found out, even in the aftermath, as you guys responded to that, you know, Esther is a fascinating book, and some of you took me up on my invitation, read the whole book, and you've already sent in some interesting questions, stuff that I'm not actually going to cover in the series, because we have cleaned this up for primetime viewing for families, and so some of the stuff we're just not going to talk about, but we'll get to those. We're going to figure out a format. I think we're going to call them Esther Extras, and we're going to get the answers to you in the format of some of the more interesting and or graphic questions you have asked. And there really are answers for them because Esther is that kind of book. Esther's also interesting because God's name is not mentioned in this book. Esther's one of those books in the Bible where God's name is, you don't find God commanded, God said, God encouraged. I mean, it's just not there. And so you build this story, and it's an amazing story about a young lady who is far from home or far from her homeland, a man who's far from his homeland, and we're going to keep moving through the story. Now, today, we're going to be at Esther chapter 2. We're going to spend all of our time there, and I'm going to kind of jump around a little bit and share with you some things about how you live out your faith, and that's with a capital F, in a small faith-filled, faithless world. Those are all little Fs, okay? And we're going to look at why that's important. If you were with us last week, for you guys, 11:15, you heard this part of it. The 9 o'clock crowd last time did not, because we didn't finish last time. But I said we would start with these verses out of chapter 2. So go to chapter 2, verses 5 and 6, and we're going to pick up right where we left off last week and roll into it. And it says this, "Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiachin, king of Judah. Now, when we read those words right now, we read that and we go, okay. Not a whole lot of reaction to it, a lot of names that we don't know how to pronounce. I'm sure I missed them up. But people who were trained in the ways and the study of Torah would read those two verses, that paragraph, and thousands of questions would explode in their mind. Now, we're removed from that. I mean, we're thousands of years removed from that. And so those questions don't explode for us. But if they did, one of the main questions ought to be, why would people who were chosen to identify as God's chosen people live like this? Now you say, well, it's simple. They're captives. Okay, they're in exile. But if you were with us last week, you also heard the fact that any Jew who wanted to leave had already had the opportunity to leave. So they've chosen to stay there. They're there. Why? And so let me give you a brick. We said we normally would give out principles. We're not giving out principles. We're giving bricks because of the back against the wall thing. We have a backdrop, so we got to call it bricks. And so this is a principle, or a brick, if you will, that we're going to build some ideas around as well as some main points. But this is the first brick of the day. A life touched by God always ends in touching others. A life touched by God always ends in touching others. And what I want you to know is while we ask the question about this guy named Mordecai and eventually this woman named Esther, the questions that we're asking, while they are important, what we do know is the end game. We know what's happening in the story. If you've already read ahead, you know how the story's end. They are there for a reason. They're there for a purpose. Now, that's a simple answer. God's got a purpose in it. But as simple as that answer is, hear me carefully. God has a purpose for your life, too, that's just as important. And I know that sometimes it's easy for us to get up and move through the course of a day and think, you know, it's just a day. It's just me. I don't have a whole lot going on. I don't have any great skill set. I don't have any resources to draw from. I don't really feel like I have anything to offer. It's just me. But what I want you to know is that God has a purpose for you. And any life that God has touched, God always ends in touching others. In other words, he's going to take you and use you for something that is bigger and bolder than anything you ever thought. What it is, I don't know. That's for God to fill in the gaps. That's for you to choose to live out or not to live out. It's up to you. But I do know that when God touches your life, it's not an accident. And I know for a fact, as we move into the story once again, even though we start with asking that question, which is a good question, it's a good study question, there's a reason that they're there, and the reason is simply because God has still got these folks, and they're chosen to do something. They're going to do something amazing. Mordecai, Esther, God's going to use them in a powerful way. And ultimately, Esther is going to save an entire nation of people. But we're not there yet. That comes later in the series. So let me begin by simply asking you this simple question. Who are you? Now, most of you can answer that question in a variety of ways. You can identify as a number of different things. So we go back to the passage and we say, well, what was Mordecai doing in the citadel of Susa? Because the citadel of Susa would be like me saying to you, I live on Capitol Hill in Washington. Okay, where Mordecai was in the center, the epicenter of influence and government in Persia. Most of the Jews that were exiled would get as far away as they could from that. They didn't want to deal with the mess and they didn't want to deal with the scrutiny. So what they would do is they would live in the perimeters. They would live in the suburbs, if you will. They moved into the suburbs. They didn't want to get caught in the traffic downtown. They didn't want to get caught in the Beltway loop. They didn't want to do any of that stuff. They wanted to be as far away as they possibly could. Get them away. Because they're in exiles, I mean, they're not really apart, but they're able to function there. But, you know, just get me out of that hub of what's going on. But Mordecai, no, that's not him. So while most Jews would have stayed away from that, Mordecai finds himself in the center of Persian politics and power. Look at verse 21. During the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthana and Teresh, sound like wrestlers, two of the king's officers, guarded the doorway, and they became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. The implication here is that Mordecai may have been on the payroll. Mordecai may have actually worked for Xerxes. He's there in the gate of the citadel. He was in the thick of the political thicket. Mordecai, in some ways, was a big deal in a foreign land, which isn't a big deal, unless, of course, you're one of God's chosen people living in exile in a pagan culture. And so, as he lived his life, maybe making his living on the payroll of a pagan king, his Hebrew distinctiveness, if you will, is lost. For three generations, he's gotten further and further and further away from his heritage. Look at verse 7. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, who he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This young woman, who was also known as Esther, had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother had died. Hadassah comes from the Hebrew word that means righteous. And so that is Esther, and that's who we know her as. And so Esther is getting ready to become part of a new television show called The Bachelorette. And she's getting ready to be a contestant. Now, we talked last week about how this happened. There wasn't a whole lot of choice in this. This was not a happy choice that they had to make. But this was, and again, by way of quick review, and again, we talked about it last week, the king, Xerxes, richest man in the world, one of the most powerful men in the world, asked his wife, the queen, to do something that she just refused to do and should have refused to do, and so they banished her. He got these folks to go along with him and support his attempt to conquer the Greeks, and it had gone horribly wrong. He has come back at the end of that and walked into a lonely palace, and when he cried out, "Honey, I'm home," there was no one to say, "Oh, how was the war, dear?" And he's lonely, and he feels bad, and those around him who are trying to keep this powerful man happy say, "Let's have a contest. Let's have a contest. Let's put on a show. Let's call it The Bachelorette. And we'll get women from every one of the provinces around us, every one of the regions around us." And so they brought these women in to become part of the king's bachelorette show. Now, we talked about the fact, though, this is a one-way trip for these ladies. Women could be banished very easily. And so for these women, they were ripped from their homes, they left their homes, and were brought to the king's palace, and they would be there as part of this contest, and they would become a part of the harem or the concubine of the king. But they were not going back home. There was going to be one winner who would be the queen. But then all of the losers were still going to live there in the palace for the rest of their days to be used as the king saw fit. So when you talk about over 1,000 women coming for this contest, this is not a happy goodbye, good luck, dear, hope you win when they leave home. This is serious business. And Esther is one of those women. Verse 8 through 10. When the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many young women were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Haggai. Esther also was taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Haggai, who had charge of the harem. She pleased him and won his favor. Immediately he provided her with her beauty treatments and special food. He assigned to her 7 female attendants selected from the king's palace and moved her and her attendants into the best place in the harem. And in verse 10, Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. It's easy to read the story and forget what we read there. When it says Esther was taken, we just talk about that. She wasn't taken in the sense of, you know, hey, come on by. She was taken. And she was taken and she was put away, she was locked away, and she wasn't going to leave. And in verse 10, we find out that Esther does know who she is. She does know her background. She does know her nationality. How do we know? Because it says so. And she kept her mouth shut because Mordecai had told her, don't say a word. So now Mordecai and Esther's story begins to kind of gel just a little bit more than it did maybe last week. They are aware. They're 3 generations removed from living in Jerusalem, but they do know who they are. They do know their background. They're aware of it. And so now Esther is going to keep her mouth shut because that's what Mordecai has told her to do. And she's struggling in this environment that she's in. She's struggling in this place that she's in, and she's got to figure out how to survive it. You ever felt that way in the culture you live in? You know, see, when I ask the question, who are you? Maybe a broader way to ask it is, who are you in the culture that you find yourself in today? Because we understand hidden identities. I mean, how many times has it been that you, as a follower of Christ, found yourself in an environment and you heard something going on, you knew you needed to say something, but you just didn't say it because you didn't want it to be embarrassed, you didn't want people to think you were odd for God, or you didn't want people to think you were weird, or even worse, kick you out of the group, so you kept your mouth shut. You hid your identity. How many times have you found yourself in an environment where you knew what you should do, you knew that there was a stand that you needed to take, you knew that someone needed to speak up on behalf of someone else, and someone needed to rally and be a defender of whatever was godly truth, but you just didn't do it because why? Because, well, the pressure was on. Nobody else was going to do it. And so you made a choice. You know, I don't want to mess up my influence. I'm going to keep my mouth shut and hope there's a better time. See, we've all done it, and we've all felt guilty about it. There have been moments that I knew I needed to speak up. There's been moments that you needed to do something to speak up, and we all have backed off of that. And we do it in a variety of settings. People do it all the time. They do it in school. They do it in clubs. They do it in workplaces. They do it on social media. I mean, we hide who we're supposed to be, and who we're supposed to be is someone who is saved by the grace of God, and that love of God flows through us. I mean, we are to be godly representatives in a world that desperately needs to hear it. But sometimes we feel like the pressure of the culture has backed us up against the wall, and we lost who we are in that. And we don't know how to navigate, and so we step into the story of Esther and Mordecai, and we find out that in their case, man, they're keeping it quiet. They're low-key in it. And again, we know how their story ends. So we know there's a purpose in that. But here's what I know about you. I know how your story ends. See, wherever you are, however you feel right now, God's got a purpose in it. And I'm not going to beat you up by saying maybe you should have spoke up or maybe you ought to say something. I'm not going to do that because we've all been there. We've all had that struggle. Who needs that guilt? But what we do need to do is be very, very careful and make sure that we pick the spots and learn to look for the spots that God gives us so that we can be obedient in the moment and make the impact we're supposed to have. My fear is sometimes we don't want to do that. My fear sometimes is we've just gotten so good at hiding who we are, it's just easier not to. In Persia, interestingly enough, when Persia conquered people, they didn't make them quit worshiping the gods that they worship. Persia was very easy to get along with. Persians would conquer you, and they would come in and say, you can keep worshiping whoever you worship, as long as you add to that our gods and you worship when we say worship. So you can worship whoever you want, and just include our gods in the mix. We'll let you know what to worship and when to worship. You worship them, and you just worship all you want. You have complete freedom. And then the audacity to think, here are some people who are chosen by God as God's chosen, who know there's only one true God, and we can only worship one true God. That's the story of the Old Testament, right? And so they're dropped into that mix, knowing that they can't even worship without exposing who they are. But the Persians, they were so tolerant. You could worship anybody and anything as long as you didn't have the audacity to say there's only one true God and only one God worth worship. You ever notice that that's kind of the way it works in our world today? I mean, we live in a world that says we can believe anything. We live in a world that says all roads lead to heaven. That's silly. We live in a world that says, you know, you just go with your gut however you feel. You know, you're in touch with God. You can worship any way you want, as long as you don't tell me there's only one way to heaven. And if I don't believe your way, I'm going to go to hell? That's not very tolerant now, is it? And so in a culture that says we're tolerant of all beliefs, I dare you, step up and say, you know what? You're all wrong. There's only one way. See how tolerant that tolerant culture is to you. See, those that say we're tolerant are the least tolerant to those that dare to have something to stand on, those that dare to say we're going to have faith, real faith, in a world that's full of people with faith in a whole lot of stuff, but really are faithless. Living out your faith in a faith-filled, faithless world is tough to live and tough to say. And you have to make the choice. Okay, God, I'm going to trust you. I'm going to be so in touch with you that I'm going to read the signs on this thing. I'm going to listen to you, and I'm going to know when it's time, and I'm going to know what to say when I'm supposed to say it. I'm going to know what to do when to push back against this wall, because I know who I am, and who I am is your child. That's Mordecai. That's Esther. And they're living in a world where it gets tough. And so, one of the things that happens to us is there is a moment that comes that we do have to step out. For us, next week we're going to see that moment that I would call for Mordecai and Esther a come to Jesus moment. But this is Old Testament, so that's not really what's happening there. But for us, it's a come to Jesus moment where you're going to have to decide what it is you're going to do. We'll get there next week, so stay with the series. Don't give up on it. We just won't get there today. But let me give you another brick. The brick is this. Don't be surprised what God asked you to do yesterday is insufficient for your journey of faith today. Don't be surprised if what God asked you to do yesterday is insufficient for your journey of faith today. What I simply mean by that is you're not called by God to live an endless loop of Groundhog Day religious experiences. You're not supposed to live the same day over and over and over and over again. You're supposed to be growing. You're supposed to be changing. You're supposed to be transforming. God's supposed to be doing something different in your life. And as he grows you and he moves you from day to day, and as you live each day to the fullest for him, he is growing you and preparing you for the next day. I know folks, and I've hung out in church a long time, where what they've done is they've chosen to relive one religious experience over and over again, and they've never grown. And they've never grown beyond that first moment. And they think, well, I'm always trying to capture that moment where I'm on the mountaintop. Let me tell you about your spiritual life. You experience that mountaintop moment. You come off that mountain into the valley to find another mountain to climb and have another mountaintop moment. Your life is like this. You don't stay here and build your altar. Jesus talked about that, by the way, with Peter, James, and John. You're moving forward, and you're constantly going forward. And here's what I know because of what I have seen around me. The culture is shifting around us, and the culture around us today is changing. This is not the same world that it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Some of you are a child of the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. You've come along, and there's been a whole lot of changes that have taken place. And you think sometimes in your head, boy, it'd be nice if we could go back that way. Well, let me tell you, you ain't going back that way. It's not going to happen. Because we don't move backwards. The call of God is always forward. And while you can long for the good old days, you can do that so long that you miss this day. Don't miss this day by longing for the good old days. And don't kid yourself. What you needed to do then is not what you need to do now, because the culture's not the same. You ever had a kid look back and say, this is... You don't understand the world I grew up. This is not the world you grew up in. You know what I've come to the conclusion? They're right. They're absolutely right. I grew up in a day where the video game was Pong. Were you good at it? I was pretty good at it. Yeah. It was Pong, and we were rich because we had Pong. Man, rich people had Pong. I grew up in a rich household. We had Pong. Boop, boop. I mean, it was awesome. I mean, you used to have to go someplace to play video games. You couldn't stay in your house and play. You couldn't play on your phone because we didn't have phones like that. We had phones with dials that you had to remember numbers. And sometimes it would even hurt your finger when you were a kid dialing the number. You had to pull all the way over and let it go all the way back. Kids don't know that. My first cell phone was this big. I had to lay it on the ground, put my ear here, and then talk here, and then put my ear here, and talk here. I mean, things have changed. Our kids don't understand that. If your kid can't take your phone and call up a YouTube video right now to show you what's so important to them, they think something's wrong with you. Did you not pay your bill? Do we not have internet? Do we have streaming here? What is wrong? What happened then isn't happening now. This world is different. And you got to deal with that. You don't have to like it. I didn't say you have to like it. I just said you have to deal with it. Mordecai probably didn't like the fact that he was stuck there in Susa. But he was, and he knew he was supposed to be there for a reason. And so ask yourself this question. God, where have you positioned me today that I can make an impact? Where have you positioned me today that I can have an impact? Because I can promise you this, wherever you are today, God's put you there for a reason. He knows that you're there, and you can make an impact. And if God has blessed you, then you have something to share. I shared with the Sunrise Bible Study crowd just a little while ago. Make sure what you share is a gift, not a curse. Because one way or the other, you're going to share something. So don't let people bump into you and walk away with, whoo, whoo, I don't want to see them again. When you bump into someone, make sure that they walk away thinking, man, that person's a gift from God in my life, and I see the blessing that's there. Second thing I want you to see is also want you to see grace in the face, grace in the face. Look at verse 9 and 10. She pleased him and won his favor. Immediately he provided her with her beauty treatments and special food. He assigned her to 7 female attendants selected from the king's palace, moved her and her attendants to the best place in the harem. Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. That phrase there that says that she won his favor, the literal translation of that in Hebrew is, she lifted up grace before his face. Isn't that awesome? That's a great line. She lifted up grace. Put it right in his face. You know, believe it or not, as a follower of Christ, you ought to be doing that all the time. You ought to be lifting up grace and putting it in the face of people. When you deal with people, is that what they would say about you? See, for Esther, her attitude and her spirit allowed her to model grace in the midst of what were bad circumstances. I mean, we can't even imagine what this would be like. Our imaginations, even on their worst days, can't imagine the angst, the pain, the fear, all of this that was going on. We have such a hard time getting here, but yet here we have a young lady who is now with one of the king's most influential servants who models for him what the Bible describes as grace in his face. And when he looks at her, he is so struck by who she is, not her beauty, but who she is inside as well, that becomes so compelling to him that he wants to do his best to help her in what is a bad situation. And by the way, he knows it's a bad situation. I mean, notice what the details are here. We're not going to bog down. But he gives her 7 attendants from the palace. Why? Because he knows that these attendants know what works in the palace. Chances are very, very real that they worked for Queen Vashti back in the day, before she got banished. So this guy had the influence to say, I'm going to put these women with Esther. And then move Esther to the best place in the harem. Didn't get out of the harem, but put her in the best place in the harem. In other words, he is doing everything that he can to help her. Why? Because in this world that's falling apart around them, and all the emotion and all the drama and all the trauma that's taking place, here's a young woman who is lifting up grace into this man's face, and he's seeing something different about her and says, I can't do everything to help you. Here's how I can help. And he catches a glimpse of God in her. And she keeps her mouth shut about being Jewish. Verbal restraint, certainly lost in our culture today. Yeah. And we see how her faith collides with the wall. Because here she is now as a Jewish woman trying to figure out what to do next and how to act. Let me give you another brick. The brick is simply this. Do what you know you should do, and then you'll know what to do next. You ever had moments that you don't know what to do? Had those moments you go, I don't know what you want to do. Let me give you the best spiritual advice that I could ever give you. Go with what you know. I mean, you don't have to be a spiritual rocket scientist. Just do what you know you're supposed to do next. And when you do what you're supposed to do next, you'll discover that God has an amazing ability to clarify what he wants us to do in the midst of our being obedient. One of the reasons that sometimes we're not obedient is because we already know. We don't know what to do. So what do? Nothing. We just don't do anything. We never take an action. We never put anything to gear. We never start moving forward. And so as a result, we just don't do anything. And because of that, then we never discover what it is that God has for us. One of the prayers that you can offer in your life, this is another good now what, is God, help me today be grace in the face of someone who needs it. Wouldn't that be a great way for someone to describe you? Hey, I met so-and-so today. Well, what did you think about them? Man, I put grace right in my face. Now, as long as grace isn't tattooed on their knuckles, that's okay. But you want to make sure that you're offering that grace to other people. Can you do it? No. Can you do it because the Spirit of God lives in you? Oh, yeah. Sure. Of course you can. Because then you're not doing the heavy lifting. He is. So take the challenge. Be grace in the face of a world that needs to see grace. Because they have faith in a whole lot of things, but you have faith in the one true God. And that gives you a chance to live differently. The last thing I want you to see is also, she was able to be humble without a stumble. She was able to be humble without a stumble, and so can you. In verse 10, Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. If you drop down to verse 20, it says this, but Esther kept her secret, her family background and nationality, just as Mordecai had told her to do, for she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions as she had done when he was bringing her up. Even becoming a finalist in the bachelorette contest didn't change her. See, these verses remind us that she remembered what she had learned. She didn't forget where she had come from. They remind us that she was still teachable, that she was still willing, even though she was just a heartbeat from being the queen of Persia, that she was still willing to listen to those who had poured her life into her. She had a teachable heart, and it didn't tumble when the circumstances around her began to slip and slide. She didn't let go of the things that she had always heard when the crisis came. She didn't kick to the curb all the things that she had been taught and that had been instilled in her when the tough times came. Anything but. Matter of fact, it reminds us that she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions, just as she had from the time that he raised her as a girl. She had discovered that he was wise, that he had a heart for God, and that she could trust him. Now, there's nothing in the story to this point, we're only in chapter 2, that indicates that she has any big picture of what's going on here. She doesn't. Not in this part of the story. So what you have when you strip away the layers of this story is you have a young woman who is holding on to the teaching. She's teachable enough, and she's going to do what the people who have poured her life into her told her to do. That's Mordecai. She's handling it with grace and style. She's reflecting an inner beauty that's impacting the world around her. And she is doing the best that she can in a back-against-the-wall situation. And she doesn't know how this is going to end. She doesn't know how it's going to play out. So all she has is obedience in the here and now. See, the culture sometimes that we live in will force us against the wall. And when it does, we make a decision whether or not we're going to jettison what we know, what we've been taught, what we've heard, those things that have helped get us to where we are. But yet if God is in the mix, and he is, by the way, then where you are in this moment is not a surprise to him. What's going around in the world right now is not a surprise to him. And he wants you to remember that you are loved, and he wants you to find your identity in him. And when you find your identity in him, then you can push off that wall. The pastor shared the story. He had the opportunity to go back to his hometown and pay respects to his father and mom who had passed away. It had been 35 years since he had been back to that hometown. And so he made that journey back, like many people have done, to go back and just visit the cemetery, see it. Not to accomplish anything other than just to say that they did it and just go see how things were. It had been a long, long time. He wasn't worried about finding the grave. He knew he would find the grave because it was the only burial spot that was going to have a live oak tree by it. Now, the cemetery had many, many trees. At 9 o'clock, I said the seminary had many, many trees. And it dawned on me, seminary and cemetery are very close. And, of course, seminary is where old pastors go to die. But anyway, at the cemetery, it had a lot of trees. But in this particular case, he remembered that his father had made a request. His father had just been diagnosed with a disease that they knew would ultimately take his life. And so he started to get his affairs in order. And when he began to get his affairs in order, he asked the cemetery for permission to plant this oak tree. Now, oak trees grow at all angles. They have those knuckle trunks. I mean, they just spread out. But he remembered his dad wanting this to be part of his final wishes. This was putting his estate in order, and so he did. And he remembered as a kid going there and actually reaching his hand around this little tree It was only about this big at the time, and as a little kid, he could get his hand around the tree and touch his middle finger and the thumb together around the trunk of that tree. Now, 35 years later, as they walked into the cemetery, he saw the tree. The tree is now as thick as a man's torso. Time has passed. What he wasn't prepared for is what he saw on the tree. Because what he saw on the tree was a heart that had been carved into the tree. See, when his father was putting his affairs in order, he had carved a small little heart into that little tree, and then in the center of that heart were the initials of all of his children. And through the years, as the tree grew, the heart grew, and the initials could be seen clearer and clearer and clearer. His dad never told him he did it. But his dad knew that there would come a day that he would make the trip back and need, for whatever reason, to be reminded that his daddy loved him. That trip to the cemetery was a life-shaping, life-changing trip because it reminded him of who he was and where he had been. And I want you to know, if you're a follower, God has not carved your name into a tree. He's done something better. He's engraved his heart, and he's put it on a cross, and he's carved your name in crimson blood across that. And every year that passes, every day that passes, that cross continues to grow, that heart gets bigger, and your name is in the middle of it, because there is something for you to do and someone for you to be and something for you to become in a world that desperately needs the love of Christ. That's your job. You were made for this moment. The back against the wall, I don't know what to do, I don't know which way to go next, but I've got to do something. This is your moment. We don't exist in time and place in history for no reason. This is your moment. And you have to decide, am I going to be who I was created to be? Am I going to step up and get serious about this thing? Or am I going to every other namby-pamby excuse for why I can't do something rule my life? You are a child of the King if you know Jesus. If you made the decision to believe, trust, and follow him, you're his child and nothing can touch you. Satan is afraid of you. Greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. You don't have to be fearful. You don't have to be paralyzed with the fear virus. You don't have to succumb to the fears that the whole world is surrounded by. You can step up, step in, and become that person that makes a change because you can come off of that wall. Because you're made for this moment. Would you bow your heads and hearts and let's pray together. God, you change everything. Graves become gardens. Life shifts. We discover faith, real faith, in a world where people talk about faith all the time. And yet, the world really is faithless. And God, we have the opportunity to choose to follow you. Lord, there are some in this room, some who are watching this, some who will watch this later. It won't be live, but they never made a decision to believe, trust, and follow Jesus. If they're here before they leave this morning, I pray that they would take a worship flyer and fill it out and just check that box and say, I want to ask Jesus into my heart. I want to accept Jesus as Savior. And put it in the giving kiosk on the way out the door so we can contact them and say, this is what you need to do. This is what happens. This is what it means. This is what happens next. If they're watching right now, I pray that they would just send an email to us at the address that's there and just simply say, that's the choice I need to make today. Because by making that choice, they've taken the first step toward coming off the wall and pushing back into a world with the love of Christ. Lord, for many who will watch, many who are here this day, it's just easy to get bogged down trying to navigate this culture that we live in. And we're surprised, I think, in some ways, to find an Old Testament story that seems to speak and resonate so much with that. But Lord, help us to take the truth of your word this day and be reminded again of just how powerful you are and how you're at work, even when we don't see it, even with us. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.